From California to Maine, Utah to Kentucky, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, think gas prices are too high? Plans are afoot in the nation's capital to add a carbon tax to the cost of fossil fuels. Bill Kirpin from American Commitment is here to explain. A failed assassination attempt on Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh is the result of inflammatory left-wing rhetoric. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Phil Rossetti of R Street joins Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine for a look at President Joe Biden's misuse of the Defense Appropriations Act. And once again, President Biden failed to appropriately commemorate the anniversary of the D-Day invasion. On his American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says, perhaps the president's own lack of military experience is to blame. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. With gasoline prices at historic high levels, there is a move underway to impose a carbon tax on energy producers. That would further inflate the price at the pump. Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment, and he is here to discuss the issue. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, there is once again, or still in Washington, discussion about a so-called carbon tax. We're going to talk about who is unexplainably trying to push for this now in a couple of minutes, but what is a carbon tax?
Well, it's a tax on energy, essentially, and it's set as a dollar amount per ton of carbon dioxide emitted. And so different proposals have different dollar amounts, but the idea basically is the amount of carbon dioxide that's associated with using a fuel becomes attached to that fuel as a tax at some point in the supply chain, either at the wellhead for natural gas or at the coal mines or at the power plant level. I mean, there are different ways it can be implemented, but the bottom line on any of them is that you raise the price of fossil fuel energy based on the amount of greenhouse gas associated with it.
We already have record high gas prices and perhaps looming supply shortages. So why in the world would anybody be proposing this at this point in time?
Well, it's pretty crazy. I think it's a horrible idea at any time myself, but especially when prices are already so high and people are suffering the consequence of that every single day when they try to figure out, we got people now who are just every time they fill up the gas tank, putting it on a credit card bill that they can't pay because they have no other option. And you're having people in Washington say, now's the time to throw a tax on top of that. So it's pretty hard to answer that question of why anyone would even conceive of it. I suspect that the idea is something along the lines of, well, when prices are so high anyway, if you bury another 25 or 50 cents or whatever it is in there, then it'll stay permanently as a source of government revenue, but people won't necessarily notice it the way they would have if you put it on when the price was lower. But other than cynical explanations like that, it's pretty hard to understand why it's even being discussed.
Also hard to understand is why are organizations like the American Petroleum Institute and the Business Roundtable, why are they engaged in discussions about having a carbon tax?
This is the craziest one is the American Petroleum Institute, because that is the lobbying entity for the large oil and gas companies, the integrated, BP and Shell and Exxon and so forth. And you might think, well, I don't need to worry about advocating with my elected officials not to do anything dumb like tax energy because, quote unquote, big oil has so much lobbying power, and they'll stop things like that. And, in fact, as it turns out, big oil is practically begging for the government to tax their own customers, which is really a head-scratcher. It's hard to understand why they would be doing that. And we only know about it because their slide deck that they've been shopping all over town somehow leaked to the Wall Street Journal. And by the way, attached to that slide deck was, we need to keep this quiet because Republicans might come back into power, and we don't want them retaliating against us or being angry at us for pushing this carbon tax that Republicans are against. So there's there's sort of built-in kind of cynicism and political calculation with the fact that they're even circulating this idea. If I had to guess why, I would say there are basically two sort of impulses behind it. One is just that corporate America has become so woke and so politically correct that they're going to advocate for kind of left-wing doctrine even against the interests of their own customers and against their own business interests. And global warming, climate change has become unassailable litany that everyone has to be in favor of acting on. And so that's where the corporate CEOs are, including of the oil and gas companies. That's explanation number one. Explanation number two is that they're still under the delusion that if they agree to taxing their customers, they'll somehow buy relief from the various crazy anti-energy regulations that the left has pushed from the EPA and the Interior Department, et cetera, et cetera. And you often hear this from kind of the right of center groups that say carbon tax is the way forward, but no one on the left has ever offered such a deal. And so they'll say, thank you very much for the tax. We'll continue to push the regulations. And so they may be motivated in part by a naive belief that they can buy peace from the green groups and the left by having a tax and escape from kind of the regulatory onslaught. I think that's naive and unlikely to succeed. But I just think it's a general kind of, you know, the corporate America has become very left-wing, including the oil and gas industry, at least the majors. I think the smaller independent producers are still against all of this stuff, but the majors have kind of fallen under the spell of the green groups and the activist investors, et cetera.
Taking a look at the larger picture here, Phil, we really have demand returning to normal, maybe going past where it was before the pandemic hit. We also have supply being constricted because of the anti-energy policies of the Biden administration. Really, when it comes to green energy, is green energy, has it been developed to the point where it can actually backfill the demand here if we don't have the supply of fossil fuels that we need?
No. If it could, then we wouldn't be seeing the price shocks that we're seeing right now. And you know, I have nothing against any kind of energy technology. If people want to buy an electric car, that's fine. But I'm against subsidizing it, and I'm against punishing oil and gas production. And what we've got with this administration, it's especially sinister, because not only do they have all of the explicit regulations and restrictions and canceling pipelines and banning oil and gas leases in federal lands and waters, et cetera, but they also have kind of this collusion with Wall Street and with the hedge funds and with the pension funds and the university endowments, and they've got the whole ESG and DEI push, and they're basically making it so that people who do want to produce oil and gas can't get capital. They're shutting off the flow of capital to that production, and they're also creating sort of the expectation of future hostile regulations. And so we're not seeing the normal market reaction that we should with prices where they are now. With prices where they are right now, we should have seen supply stimulated much more than we have seen. And you can just see that by comparing internationally to what's happened in other countries. And, you know, we've lost something like 10% versus our international competitors, places like Russia and the OPEC countries. And so that tells you that that supply is not responding to a price signal in the U.S. the way it should be in the current situation. That's all been caused by the Biden administration and their naive belief, as Pete Buttigieg says all the time, if you can't afford gas, buy an electric car. Marie Antoinette stuff. It's really bizarre that but you know, you can't say it's a gaffe when they say it over and over and over again. And so I just think they've got this obsession with, we're going to transition everyone off of fossil fuels, but the economics really don't work for the vast majority of people. And you know, that's why they're causing so much pain right now.
Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. Phil, tell us a bit about American Commitment. Also, you have written on this and other topics. Where can folks go on the web to find that?
We're a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues. We try to focus on the ones that are really on the margin, where people having more information can make a difference in these fights. And all our stuff is on the web at americancommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin from American Commitment. Phil, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Loman. Have a good one.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on what is occurring on Capitol Hill. We also have some other very distressing developments that have occurred this past week. We're going to talk about them with Scott Parkinson. Good to have you here, Scott.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
It was very disturbing last week, Scott. There was a foiled assassination attempt on Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Tell us a little bit about what happened and why has Congress not moved over the last few weeks since the leak of the potential draft opinion in the Dobbs case relative to abortion. Since the threat level has been elevated, why has Congress not acted?
Let's just back up, first of all. I'm on Capitol Hill today, and sorry if it's a little bit noisy in the background, but I'm just a couple of blocks away from the Supreme Court right now, and the Supreme Court is surrounded by the same fencing that surrounded the Capitol after January 6th. The court is terrified of the threat that many folks on the internet and the radical left have been making against justices in fear of the court case related to abortion. This is the Dobbs case out of Mississippi, and we are expecting that case to be announced any day. And when you go back to the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, Chuck Schumer, the majority leader in the United States Senate, basically gave everybody carte blanche authority to threaten these justices, and Brett Kavanaugh in particular. We all remember that viral video where it was basically a call to arms against conservative justices. And I just think it's so irresponsible for people like Chuck Schumer to activate their base in a hostile, criminal, and illegal fashion. So this week, we had a potential assassin detained by the Federal Bureau of Investigations. An FBI agent was in plain clothes, and there were a couple of other officers that sort of flagged this guy getting out of a taxi cab and having a suitcase and a backpack and wearing black. And when he saw the officers, he kind of turned the other direction. And what he did was he called 911 and said he was having suicidal thoughts. So the agents went in, detained him, and not only did they find a Glock on him, but they found a knife. They found a screwdriver. They found a crowbar. They found all sorts of weapons that could be used to harm, torture, and hurt one of the associate justices on the court. And aside from just that, it's clearly a huge, huge threat to the preservation of our constitutional republic. We need to make sure that we have a strong judiciary. And all those folks on the Supreme Court were confirmed by the United States Senate underneath the rules and procedure that the Senate has for confirmation and advice and consent following a nomination by the President of the United States. And some people just can't handle the truth. And I think it's pretty alarming when the radical left is willing to really send out assassins to threaten the security of the court. The United States Senate earlier did pass unanimously a bill that would provide for more security for all the justices. But this week, Nancy Pelosi and those radical Democrats in Congress blocked the bill. The same day that the affidavit was released against this criminal, Nancy Pelosi blocked the bill to provide for more security for all of our justices.
Well, what we have here is a situation where if anything occurs, it certainly is on the hands of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. Another thing on the hands of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi is the federal budget or lack thereof. This is a process, Scott, that sometimes makes people's eyes glaze over, but it is underway. And do we actually have a federal budget? Are we working toward a federal budget?
Well, you remember earlier this year when Joe Biden introduced his so-called budget that would have added $15 trillion to the national debt through annual deficits exceeding $1 trillion every single year. And this week, the Republican Study Committee, an organization on Capitol Hill that I previously was the executive director for, actually offered the first congressional budget out of anybody. Democrats haven't released a budget. House minority Republicans haven't released a budget. But this caucus, the Republican Study Committee, did offer a plan to get to balance within just about 5 years. That's an aggressive plan. It offers reforms to Social Security and Medicare and all these drivers of the debt and deficit. And it also provides for tax relief and economic growth that would make a big, big difference when it comes to the inflation that all of us are experiencing now through an energy crisis at the gas pump all the way to wage growth completely being stifled by this inflation. And so underneath the Budget Act of 1974, Congress can actually proceed to appropriation bills without a budget. And they made that announcement this week with a schedule for all the markups on the House Appropriations Committee. So we should be expecting that in the coming weeks. And then I don't think any of those bills are going to pass the United States Senate. But we get back to this idea of what's called a continuing resolution that funds government at current levels. But as we mentioned earlier with the Supreme Court case, there is going to be a big question among congressmen and women on whether or not to continue to provide federal funding for abortion, presuming that the Dobbs case is affirming this state right on whether or not abortion should be permitted and reversing Roe v. Wade.
As we go through this budget year, is this going to be another situation where we're going to be a couple of days before Christmas and there's some sort of gigantic omnibus spending bill that absolutely has to pass and it's going to go through and all sorts of bad things are going to happen?
Well, I don't mean to sound like the Grinch, and I don't think you do either. And we all like to open up little presents and share with our family and friends. But the bottom line is, this is the process that Congress has repeatedly engaged in that gives us the so-called Christmas wish list, where all sorts of anomalies that are unrelated to appropriations get loaded up onto a bill. We call it sometimes a Christmas tree because you got all these goodies and packages riding underneath a fundamental bill like funding the federal government.
We will, of course, keep an eye on this process as it unfolds throughout the balance of the year with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We're united in the idea of economic freedom, economic liberty, and economic opportunity. If anybody wants to learn more, you can actually sign up for free to be a member of the Club for Growth at clubforgrowth.org. Join over 500,000 other Americans in doing that.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Okay, thank you.
President Joe Biden is misusing the Defense Production Act to micromanage some sectors of the American economy. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Phil Rossetti of R Street.
The Defense Production Act was passed all the way back in 1950, but for most of the past several decades, it's not something we've heard a whole lot about. Until recently, President Donald Trump, of course, invoked the Defense Production Act at the beginning of the pandemic, and now we've seen President Joe Biden use the Defense Production Act several times during his administration, including most recently just this week to promote the construction of solar panels in the United States. But none of this is really within the original scope or intention of the Defense Production Act, which seems to have increasingly become just a way for presidents to exercise central control and basically unchecked executive authority over the economy. And that's what we're going to take a close look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Phil Rossetti. He is a senior fellow for energy and environmental issues at the R Street Institute. He's been here on the program before, and he came back to talk about a piece that he's just co-authored that you can find at rstreet.org. You can't grow the economy by abusing government authority is the title of that piece. And I totally agree. Phil, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Phil, maybe we should start off by just answering the obvious question here, which is, what is the Defense Production Act? How does it work? How has the president been using it?
Back in 1950, there was, I think, a pretty reasonable understanding of, hey, there are a lot of threats of the Cold War. There are all these things that can go wrong, and there are going to be times when we might have to say that something has to happen for the national security purpose, even if the market doesn't direct it. And I think kind of like a good example of the way there are things like if you want Ford to start building tanks instead of cars, even if it's not profitable during a war, you know, that might make sense. More traditionally, the DPA has been used as kind of a light touch thing, like after a natural disaster, trying to steer like food, things that are more about addressing liability issues. What we're seeing now is, and really it's actually started President Trump toying with the idea of using DPA for coal and nuclear production, is this idea that the president can say, okay, these contracts are in the national security interest. We're going to force these contracts, or we're going to use government funds to force procurement that is not actually sanctioned or requested by Congress because we've deemed it to be in the national security interest. So it's happening with solar modules and recently critical minerals and baby formula and these things, is that the government can say, hey, you know, we've got the money, and this is a national security interest, so it doesn't matter what the rules normally are, you've got to comply with this, and there's very little liability or oversight to this process. So it was, I think, never intended initially that this is how the DPA would be used, but this is something where people are saying, hey, you know, we've got this hammer, and everything's starting to look like a nail.
I think that's a perfect metaphor, perfect way to put it, because it seems like this has just become the go-to mechanism for, I mean, you mentioned the Trump White House did use this a few times as well, but really the go-to mechanism for the Biden White House here. And it's, I think, something that libertarians have been worried about for a while is this idea that, like, we will just conflate national security with anything that is important. And those two things mean different things, right? Like the example you gave earlier of, well, maybe we need Ford to make tanks instead of cars because we're in the middle of a war. That's one thing. Saying we don't have enough solar panels in the country, we need to invoke the Defense Production Act to fix that. Like, that's a problem the market should fix. That's a problem that if you got regulations out of the way, the market probably would fix.
That's exactly right. And actually, it's even more extreme because the order on the BPA and what they call Section 303 order, they've also done it for heat pumps and insulation. So it's just kind of like solar panels, you could almost make that connection, say like, okay, you know, there's some energy scarcity issue, which I would not agree with that. That's a valid national security case, but it's just getting thinner and thinner the more this gets used. So this really is kind of this question of what was the intent of the law? You know, what really falls under national security, and is it too broad an interpretation? And the challenge is either the courts or Congress is going to have to define this.
Yeah, we obviously don't have a country if we don't have the government ordering people to make heat pumps, right? Like, that's the thing. We're talking with Phil Rossetti. He's a senior fellow at the R Street Institute, talking about a piece he wrote this week regarding Biden's abuse of the Defense Production Act. Phil, just a minute or so left here, but we've touched on sort of the political appropriateness here, or even maybe the legal questions of whether the law is being used correctly. But there's also sort of an economic feature to your analysis, and that is that this sort of continuous use of the Defense Production Act might actually incentivize, even more than we already have, a system where you lobby government to give you these contracts rather than go out and win in the marketplace.
Right. And this is actually the biggest problem that folks are really not focusing enough on, I think. So they're kind of, really, we as scholars understand that the way you grow the economy is by productivity improvements and letting the market identify what consumers actually view as valuable activities and letting people have this dispersed choice where you can buy what you want and producers can produce in the way that they want. This is exactly an opposite approach of that philosophy, of a central planning mindset. So what's happening is these policy folks are saying, okay, we're not going to view this as how do we increase production. We're going to view this as how can we steer resources from one area to another? And that's going to end up coming at a cost to wherever you're taking those resources from. Government doesn't produce. Government simply takes from one area and puts to another. And every one of those transactions is going to reduce the overall efficiency of the economy. So there's a bigger economic cost. And the more you go down this route, and this is really what we've seen in collapsed economies and like failed Soviet states, is that it's always been, okay, we've got this problem here, therefore we're going to use government authority to steer the resources we do have into that problem. And every time you do that, you're starting to shrink your available assets. So if they keep going down this route, it's just not going to go anywhere productive. It could be really, really detrimental. So the brakes need to be put on this abuse of power, I would say.
Terrific analysis. I have literally nothing I can add to that. Phil, thank you so much for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that's Philip Rossetti. He is a senior fellow for energy and environmental issues at the R Street Institute. Check out his work at rstreet.org. Check out our work covering the Defense Production Act, the Biden administration, everything else going on in D.C. at reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Once again this year, the commemoration of D-Day was nothing more than an afterthought for the White House. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says the president's own lack of military experience is to blame.
It's not every day that I quote from Snopes.com with approval, but here's an article from Snopes just over a year ago that's worth commending. Quote, in June 2021, U.S. President Joe Biden faced criticism from several observers and commentators, principally right-leaning critics, for his purported failure to acknowledge or commemorate the anniversary of the D-Day landings at Normandy, France, a turning point in the Allied victory in World War II, which took place on June 6, 1944. Claims that Biden had failed to acknowledge or commemorate the D-Day landings in 2021 were accurate. As a result, we are issuing a rating of, quote, true, close quote. Snopes examined official and personal social media accounts associated with Biden and the White House and found no record of any acknowledgement, mention, or commemoration of D-Day within 2 days of June 6th. Similarly, the briefing room, which is the White House's website bulletin of news releases, statements, and speech transcripts, contained no mention of D-Day during the same time period. That's the end of the Snopes post. That omission was embarrassing to the new president, especially since he routinely ends his speeches with the words, "God bless our troops." How could he have simply forgotten such an important anniversary? Surely he wouldn't make the same mistake again the following year, would he? Except that he did. Yes, on this anniversary of D-Day, President Biden once again said nothing, attended no special commemorative events, gave no speeches as President Reagan did on June 6, 1984, with his memorable Boys of Pointe du Hoc speech. During this June 6th, various commentators who were alertly awaiting a mention of the day that he had forgotten a year ago noted the repeated absence of Biden's recognition until at the very end of the day, nearly 9 o'clock Eastern time, and after it was already June 7th in France, a brief tweet was issued. Conservative commentator Greg Price couldn't believe that Biden's hefty social media team couldn't figure out how to properly tweet about D-Day. Quote, "He has like 70 people who handle his social media, and none of them thought to post something about one of the most important days in the history of our country until 8:45 p.m., Price tweeted. Prior to Biden's tweet, Washington Examiner reporter Jerry Dunleavy warned that the president might not acknowledge the anniversary. He tweeted, quote, "I noted last year that Biden didn't commemorate D-Day. They seem close to making the same mistake again this year," end quote. However, shortly after Dunleavy's tweet, the dilatory tweet from the White House was offered. Another conservative commentator referred to it as an apparent afterthought. That seems to describe it accurately. Why would the commander-in-chief of our military be so out of touch? Perhaps because Joe Biden never served in the military. Although his son Beau was a lawyer in the Delaware Army National Guard, Biden's own lack of military experience means that he never benefited from the values that all the uniformed services drill into their members, such as mission focus, discipline, and the value of teamwork. Even though my time as an officer in the Navy was relatively short, I still consider it one of the most important influences on my life. Even veterans who have never experienced combat or witnessed a fellow soldier or sailor sacrificing his or her life for the cause of the nation respond to commemorations like Memorial Day, Veterans Day, D-Day, or Pearl Harbor Day more deeply than the non-veteran. There's a lot to be said in favor of our all-volunteer military, but there's also a societal loss in such a large portion of our populace missing out on these lessons. Are the virtues of mission focus, discipline, teamwork, and leadership critical to civilian life as well as military life? I think they are, and I suggest that their absence in the personal experience of our current president contributes to his ineffectiveness. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WTVY-FM in Dothan, Alabama. Welcome to our new listeners in the Yellowhammer State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.